This is Eric Ellefson again with the Digital Education Podcast. Opportunity for me to meet people, have conversations with interesting educators, innovators, leaders in our profession, but then just an opportunity for others to listen in on some of the interesting things that are happening in that world. Today I'm with Albert Cheng. Albert, and I'm going to ask him a question about this in a little bit, but Albert was a pure mathematics major at Cal Berkeley, taught high school math here in the Bay Area where I live, was a postdoctoral research fellow at the Harvard's program on education policy and governance, and he's currently a researcher and professor at the University of Arkansas. He's done a bunch of research that I want to ask him about, and he's beginning to ask some more questions in regards to his own research. But Albert, thanks for joining us. But first question I'm going to ask you is, what is pure mathematics?
Well, thanks for having me here, Eric. Pure math. Well, this is math in its purest form, I guess, as the name suggests. Anyway, at Cal, there were two different math degrees you could get. One was pure math and one was applied. Back in the day, I didn't want anything to do with applied mathematics. I hated numerical analysis and any sort of application. I just wanted give it to me straight. Give me all the set theory and the logic and all the stuff that no one really talks about. But of course, I guess I've kind of moved on from that. I'd sit here running econometric models all day. So I've gone to the applied side a bit in practice. But anyway, I'd love any sort of conversation on, topology and abstract algebra any day.
So we'll give people your email address so that they can give you a call and just talk pure math with you.
Sure. Yeah. It's been a while.
So question in that, because you do the pure mathematics, degree at Cal. It takes you through a journey where you teach a little bit and then where you move into a master's degree and then onto your doctoral work. And in your doctoral work or in your postdoctoral program out at Harvard, you got involved in doing some analysis out there with the Education Next poll. And you had the opportunity with some of the other leaders there and writers there, Paul Peterson, Marty West, Michael Henderson.
Yeah.
You had the opportunity to write the analysis of what that poll was this year. What are we learning, as you kind of looked at the Education Next poll, as you looked at some of the trends and trajectories, as you're looking at some of the, mathematics or some of the statistics with that, what did you gather from that really, maybe a couple things that were really insightful for you as you kind of look at trends in education reform, education policy here over the last couple of years and moving into the next couple of years?
Yeah, sure. So just for the listeners out there who aren't familiar with the EdNext poll. So this is a annual poll of public opinion on educational issues, education policy issues that the group that I was a part of at Harvard runs. And so this year was our 12th annual poll. So we've been doing this for quite a bit now. Each year we get a large kind of nationally representative sample of adults, and we ask them a series of questions to get their opinion on a variety of issues that are kind of salient for the day. For instance, one of the things that we've asked over the past decade is opinion on school choice. For instance, we've long polled the public about their opinion on charter schools. And this is, you're asking about some of the more interesting findings. So actually all the way up, and I don't, for listeners who are familiar with the EdNext poll, they might remember the 2017 poll, one of the perhaps more astounding findings was a huge double digit kind of drop in support for charter schools. I think we experienced a 10 percentage point drop. I think we used to have a majority of support for charter schools, and it dropped quite a bit. And so that was kind of a big thing. And we were wondering, is that real? Or is that just a blip in our kind of statistics? As it turns out, to be real, in my opinion. Actually, if we look at the poll this year, we actually do see a partial recovery. So there's a double digit drop to, I think, like around the, you know, low 40% support, I think. This year, half of that drop was recovered. But what's interesting is that the recovery was mostly concentrated on Republicans. And among Democrats, you actually see support for charters, or I should say opposition for charters, sustained. So I think this actually illustrates one of the interesting trends in ed reform and ed policy in general, is some of the partisan divide that's kind of being revealed. Historically, even if you think about No Child Left Behind, charter schools, a lot of that was a product of a compromise. Across political aisle, there were coalitions that were non-traditional, and today some people call it the reform coalition. Definitely you see some fissures and fractures in it. That's one of the things, school choice and charter schools is one of the things that we usually do look at in the EdNext poll. There's a variety of other things, and I just encourage listeners to take a look at educationnext.org. You can find all sorts of other things that we do there. Opinion on Common Core, opinion on teachers' unions, school spending, higher ed. There's a lot of things that people can dig into there.
I think that maybe the question, follow-up question to some of that is you're in a lot of ways a researcher, analytical, kind of perspective on some of this. Why is it so important to really, in education, I think we have a lot of these conversations and the research is so broad. Why is it so important to just kind of do the analytical research and do it over a long period of time or a longer period of time?
Well, things change, look, there's a variety of ways to know things and to discern things. I like to, for myself as an academic, I remind myself every day, or at least try to, that, my calling, my vocation here is to seek the truth. And using data and statistics and econometric models, that's, and polls, that's one way to figure it out. Even within that, there are limits to what data and empiricism can tell us. It's important to take a multifaceted approach to using the tools of the trade. And so certainly we learn a lot by following things over time. So certainly with the poll, we can see changing public opinion. Just to cite some other related research, with some of my colleagues at Harvard, we just presented a paper on a study of a school voucher program that's initially started in the 90s. And now, we're observing what the impacts of that program did on college graduation. If we only looked cross-sectionally or through a limited window, that program, we would have found that it didn't really boost test scores. But then if you look long-term at other outcomes, in this case, kind of educational attainment, college completion, high school graduation, we see that the program actually had big effects on that for poor families that were participating there. So look, at the end of the day, if we want to be truth seekers, it's important to do what we can, take a variety of approaches and do our due diligence to say what we can learn about the world around us.
So let me ask a question about that research then that you did in regards to the school voucher. So this is a 1990s program, and now you're looking at kind of like the adult outcomes a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, finishing high school, finishing college, attainment levels. And so you found positive effects there.
Right.
School vouchers is such a hot topic and such a you know, a, not maybe kind of this issue that is incredibly polarizing. What does, you know, as somebody who does research and then, you know, talks about policy, what are the questions that a study like this, you know, leads you to as a researcher, but then what are some of the things that you hope might be impacted in the policy world?
So, you know, I think certainly policymakers and you know, people kind of in the policymaking world, you know, so that includes lobbyists, advocates. You know, this kind of work is informative. You know, we want to know what these programs do. Are these programs, you know, for lack of better way of describing it, making the world a better place? You know, are the students, did this program, you know, cause students to be better off than they otherwise would have been in the absence of that program? And so, you know, policymakers, you know, they care about this because they have to entertain questions about, well, do we continue the program? Do we try this program in a variety of places? Now, I should mention that the program, this is a New York program that we've studied, that this was actually privately funded. So this is, you know, this is actually a group that got together in New York City that wanted to use their own money to fund this. And so, you know, they, you know, wanted to know as well, well, you know, were our dollars being put to good use? Now it's been a long time and the program's long ended. So our findings have a little less bearing on whether they want to continue funding the program because it's not in existence anymore. Look, in the policy world, if we want to impact policy and vouch for programs that we think will make the world a better place, there is a place for thinking, you know, looking at things empirically and you know, finding out to the best of our knowledge, did it work? You know, I think it's also important not to limit ourselves to thinking about how to affect policy broadly. And this gets into some of my other work, you know, where that's not necessarily centered on policy. You know, I think it's important to recognize, as you do, Eric, that there's a lot of boots on the ground work that's happening in schools that really isn't covered by the media. Recently had a chance to visit several schools around the country for a different project. And, you know, these are schools that if you weren't in their worlds, you would never have heard of them. And, you know, I was struck by the way they serve their kids and care for their kids. And these are things that would never get talked about by policymakers or broadly in the national media. And so, you know, part of the research, you know, my hope with the work that I do too, is that, you know, I can encourage the kind of, grassroots boots on the ground efforts that are going on in local communities all over the country. You know, certainly if, you know, we have evidence and can argue that, you know, school choice can make the world a better place. You know, maybe that can empower some school leaders in certain communities to take advantage of a policy environment that makes their lives easier, that opens up opportunities for them to innovate and be entrepreneurial to expand their efforts to better serve the communities. So, look, you know, I on one hand, I want to do my best to speak to broad-based policy issues and debates. On the other hand, it's important to tell the stories that are going on and inspire, you know, local efforts, because that's where a lot of the work actually gets done.
So let me kind of take it back to the beginning, because you were a teacher. You were a math teacher. You were a math teacher at a school that, you know, I know a little bit about, and it's not too far from my community, and know the hard work that's happening there. How like informative, or how important is that experience for you early in your career? You know, how, like, what role does that play now that, as you know, kind of talk about being in schools and seeing what's happening in the local community and seeing the good work, how does that keep you maybe rooted or grounded in the sense that it keeps you in the classroom where the hard work is happening, that as you go back and do the research and go back and to do, you know, have the policy discussion, that there's these reminders of the hard work? Is there a connection for you and in your professional life and in your work between that prior experience and what you're doing now?
Yeah. I when I first went to grad school, I tried to stay as connected I could to the classroom and see what was really going on. And I'll admit it's been getting harder as I play around in academia and engage with, people who do kind of policy on the, broader kind of national or even state level scale. But look, it's a discipline that's an issue that I'm aware of, and I want to discipline myself to stay connected. And there's often people kind of draw lines in the sand here. I mean, I remember one of the common complaints that I heard from my colleagues, and this part of it's legitimate. When we had to comply with certain federal mandates or state laws, is we would vent to one another and saying, these policy folks have no idea what it's like to be a teacher, and what they're doing is completely foolish. They need to listen to us more. And then now that I've been kind of on the other side, you hear the comments about, why only if teachers would do this and that, and all of a sudden there's this kind of conflict and impasse that's going on where both sides don't want to talk to each other. And so it's been eye-opening for me to be on both sides there. But I've seen there's an opportunity though, to bring both sides together. And I think, one of the kind of pieces of wisdom that I've learned over time is that, look, we need to form these kinds of coalitions that bring folks, policymakers and practitioners together. On one hand, both sides are correct in their complaints. Both sides see things that the other side doesn't see. If that knowledge isn't brought together, both sides are worse off for not knowing. It's kind of like the old that fable with the blind mice trying to feel out an elephant. One feels the tail and makes some kind of conclusion about it. One, finds the tusk, and one maybe finds the ear, and together they all have an incomplete picture. But together, they can actually see more fully and perhaps act more wisely. I think this is where ed reform. There's definitely a fissure that's happening in what traditionally has been the coalitions. I think there's one group that's becoming, that used to push for teacher accountability, school accountability, broad national policy to try to improve schools from kind of at a higher level, of government. If we could use the bully pulpit or use the policy levers that we have at the state and federal level, maybe we could get local schools to do something. Some of these folks, and I'd lump myself in this category, we're becoming aware that, look, maybe we were a little bit misinformed, that we can't just pull levers and expect things to happen system-wide, that a lot of the action it happens at the boots on the ground level. And if we really want to make schools better, we need to think about the local part, the local efforts to establish the kind of infrastructure that's there in communities already to make change happen, to see improvement happen.
So let me close this up with, kind of, you've done some research on religious schools and the impact of religious schools. And then I think some of your broader areas of interest too are how does faith impact educators? And so, even as you drive and get a bigger picture of some of these things through the EdNext policy, you know, or the poll from mm-hmm. EdNext, the analysis of that, you know, the analysis of doing research on that private voucher program, you know, and as you continue to do some of these things, like what you've done some research on religious schools, but then you also have an interest in faith of educators, whether they be at mm-hmm. religious schools or non-religious schools. Like, what are you learning when it comes to religion, faith, kind of in the education world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Look, I mean, I guess to sum it up in the briefest terms is that, look, all these kinds of distinctive communities, you know, together with their traditions and their practices, you know, I'd argue that they all contribute to the common good in various ways. You know, there's certainly, you know, in our country and in modernity today, you know, we like to rely on the scientific process, you know, data that's allegedly neutral. We want to rely on procedures and, you know, we don't want to give in to the whims of tradition or religion because, you know, we like separation of church and state here, or we're worried about our some kind of infringement on our personal liberties if we start invoking resources from faith and religion. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's all sorts of moral and you know, social and cultural capital that's found in these kinds of communities that I'd argue actually enrich the world and make the world a better place. It brings out the, you know, the better parts of our humanity and curbs the worst parts. So, you know, one of the studies that I've done was to try to parse out, you know, is there something distinctive about faith, unique about faith that does things that perhaps a secular environment, you know, could not replicate. And so, you know, we actually did this experiment where we primed kids to, you know, think in kind of a religious mode. And then we had another condition where we got kids to think in kind of this, the secular equivalence. So for instance, we gave these kids a word scramble task, and embedded in this task, for one of the treatment conditions, were words like God and commandments and, heaven. And then we had another group of kids that were, you know, we randomly assigned, so this is all experimental, do the same kind of task, but we replaced words with secular equivalents. So instead of heaven, we, you know, use the words like college, because, you know, the secular equivalent of a religious school would be like, well, you know, it's not just about, it's not about getting into the next life. The next life is attainment, and it's, you know, making it past to the next educational, you know, milestone. So anyway, we prime kids to, you know, to think in religious terms and secular terms. And then we did all sorts of things to them to see, you know, if there were differences in outcomes. So, you know, one of the things that we did to them was to ask them questions to see how tolerant they were. You know, we measured their political tolerance. We also had a way where we measured whether they were persistent at difficult tasks. And here we actually tricked them into doing a word scramble task. We gave them 10 words, told them it was a verbal test, and they had to unscramble all 10 words. The catch was that only the first 4 words were actual English words that could be unscrambled. Then we timed how long they would spend at doing these tasks. And then, you know, at the end, we had a measure of a delayed gratification as well. And so, you know, what we found in that experiment was that we could only get kids to delay gratification, for instance, if they were primed in kind of the religious, if they were, you know, primed with the religious words. And so, you know, this was kind of a small scale psych experiment, but, you know, it does track with some of the broader work that's being done by Cardis, for instance, some of the other school choice work that my colleagues and I have done, you know, where we see that, you know, that faith-based schools kind of launch their students in these distinctive trajectories that that are different from, say, the students who attend secular schools or are kind of educated in secular environments. And so, all these things related to what we kind of traditionally understand as character and virtue formation, socializing kids into certain communities of practice that make them think about, hospitality or being benevolent, service towards others, that there is a rich heritage that's found in faith-based schools that, the kind of secular environment hasn't been able to kind of replicate equally. And so, look, at the end of the day, my own view is that we need a genuinely pluralistic kind of system of education out there that, allows and opens up, the possibility for communities, distinctive communities of practice to form, because, drawing upon a rich variety of traditions that are out there, and the good, the conceptions of their good and their orientations. I think drawing upon all that does enrich the world. And as I kind of alluded to earlier, bring out, the best parts of humanity, although, all sectors are kind of imperfectly doing this, but, I do think we're better off if we draw upon, the heritage that has existed for, the past couple millennia to make ourselves better.
It's interesting, Albert, because I've had those, similar conversations with Ashley Berner, mm-hmm. Corey DeAngelis, just recently with Nigel Genders from the United Kingdom, and kind of a vision for education and for the common good that goes above and beyond just an individual sector of type of school, right, or even just right, leadership of school, that gets us to a bigger picture of, we're part of a bigger world and part of, this interconnected nature. You use that elephant kind of analogy for research and understanding and mm-hmm. wisdom, and it's the same sort of opportunity. And so it's fun to hear you talk about it from your perspective, and to be able to add to that conversation of what does it mean for us to be in the marketplace that really supports and encourages the development of this common good. So, Albert, I really thank you for your time. I appreciate your expertise, and I'd love to be able to talk pure math with you, but I'm not your guy.
Well, yeah, maybe some of your listeners will, but anyway, great chatting with you, Eric.
Thanks, Albert, and I'll make sure that on the podcast people have your information and some of your research and some of your articles and can get connected with you to learn more.
Okay, great. Yep, been a pleasure.